Do you have any scars on your body? Scars are an enduring reminder of some of our life's most traumatic experiences. Last week, we talked about how after Jesus' crucifixion, even in his resurrection body, he still bore scars on his hands, feet, and side. We talked about how odd that is when you think about it, that Jesus' perfect resurrection body would still carry with it scars that would be a perpetual reminder throughout eternity of Jesus' deepest earthly wounds. We typically think of scars as ugly reminders of things we would just as soon forget. But Jesus' experience challenges us to rethink that. Because, as we talked about last week, think about what a scar is. A scar is a wound that is healed. A scar is a proclamation of how much I have overcome. That whatever happened to me, instead of burying me, it made me better, stronger, wiser, more compassionate, more grateful for the gift of life. It made me more beautiful. So far from resenting his scars, Jesus wears them now throughout eternity as a badge of honor. And we who wish to follow Jesus are called to do the same. To be the kind of people who, instead of getting stuck in our pain, rise from it, heal from it, and become better because of it. But that leaves the question, how do we do that? That's where we left off last Sunday and where we're going to pick up this Sunday with the how-to part. Today, we are going to take a look at a two-part biblical formula drawn from our Easter gospel passage about how we, like Christ before us, can rise from our life's deepest wounds, because as followers of Jesus, Easter is not just a miracle that happened 2,000 years ago. It's a miracle that can still happen in us, you and me, right where we are, in real time. Easter applied. Let's start with a prayer. We greet you, Jesus, our risen Lord. On this Easter Sunday, April the 12th, 2020, praying that the miracle that began in you on that first Easter Sunday will now replicate itself in us. You told us that each one of us was going to have our own cross to bear. Some deep woundedness that, like you, we are meant to overcome. We are ready to live our faith. Show us how. We ask in your holy name. Amen. So I must warn you that today's sermon may be the oddest Easter sermon that you've ever heard, because we're going to be a good ways into this sermon and you may find yourself thinking, what does this have to do with Easter? But if you will bear with me, I think it will all come together in the end, because we're going somewhere today. Last Sunday, I began to share with you some of the story of comedian Anthony Griffith's career and life. I shared how, just as Anthony Griffith was reaching the zenith of his career, and he made a name for himself, began to become a really popular comedian in the early 1990s when he hit it big on Star Search. He won the Star Search competition, and then he went on to do multiple appearances on the Johnny Carson show. Anthony Griffith, by the way, is a man of faith who gained a reputation for being a clean comedian with a bit of edge to his humor. Even though he's recently been diagnosed with MS, he still performs on a regular basis. He's a funny guy. Let me show you a little bit of his recent humor.
And I also was diagnosed with MS a few years ago. And actually, my wife knew something was going on because we were dancing one night. She said, "You okay? Because you're dancing pretty funny." And I said, "Like funny in what way?" She said, "Well, you're dancing like a white guy." And I was so scared that I rushed to the emergency room. And I told the doctor, "Hey, my wife thinks I'm dressing like that. I'm dancing like a white guy." So he put in a CD and he said, "Do the hokey pokey." And I did it, but I liked it. So that's when he said, "Yeah, something's going on, because no healthy brother likes doing the hokey pokey."
Like I said, he's a funny guy. But life hasn't always been kind to Anthony Griffith. As I told you last week, just as his comedy career was hitting its zenith in the early 1990s, his beloved infant daughter was dying of cancer. For years thereafter, he would not and did not talk about the pain. Just didn't want to talk about it, kept it all inside, because as he says, nobody wants to hear about a comedian's pain. So he kept all of that inside of himself until it began coming out sideways. He became listless, zombie-like. Eventually, he became suicidal. It was dark. It wasn't until 13 years later, in 2003, that Anthony Griffith, for the first time, publicly talked about the pain of his daughter's death. He told the story in Aspen, Colorado, at an event sponsored by The Moth, which is a storytelling consortium. I wouldn't normally show you a 9-minute video clip, but what you're about to see is worth its weight in gold, because in this video clip, Anthony Griffith vividly illustrates for us the first of two key biblical points for how we can rise from our pain like Christ. Watch this.
Please welcome Anthony Griffith, ladies and gentlemen.
Charles Dickens' classic tale, Tale of Two Cities, starts off with the phrase, "It was the best of times, and it was the worst of times." In 1990, I moved from Chicago with my family to LA to seek my fame and fortune. And in a couple of weeks of being there, I got two important phone calls. One was from the talent coordinator for The Tonight Show, offering me to have a spot as a comedian on The Tonight Show. And the second call was that my daughter's doctor had called up to say that her cancer had resurfaced. A year prior, she was diagnosed with cancer, and we fought it, and it went into remission, and now it's back. And for that next year, My life was pretty surreal because it's like two different personalities. During the day, in order to keep my daughter at home with me, I would have to learn CPR and how to work a heart monitor and administer medicine, all these technical terms, and take her back and forth, to get her platelets and blood and check up on her. And at night, I would go from club to club with the talent coordinator, and I would work on my set and try to perfect it. And I would meet veterans like George Wallace and Seinfeld and Roseanne. And I thought that everything was great because we had beat the cancer before we could beat it again. And this was the first time that I was going to be in front of millions of people on The Tonight Show. And the first time on The Tonight Show, I was extremely nervous. All I could think about while I was backstage being introduced was, don't mess up. Just don't mess up. Whatever you do, don't mess up. And the curtains open, and there's 600 people, and the cameras, and Johnny's over there, and the band is over there. And I don't know what I said for the next 6 minutes, but I got six applause breaks. And the great part of that night was that I was going to my car, and I met Johnny, who was going to his car. And it was just a private moment between us in the parking lot of him saying, you were very funny. You're extremely funny. Start working on your second Tonight Show, because I want you back. By the time I got the official call for my second Tonight Show, my daughter, was admitted to the hospital. If you don't know about cancer, when it comes back hard. It's like beating up a gangbanger for the first time, and then it's coming back, and he's coming back meaner and stronger, and he's coming with his friends. So in order to compensate for that, you have to raise the chemo, and you have to raise the medicine, and you have to raise the radiation, which is difficult for an adult, but she was only two. So she's bald, which she doesn't mind because every kid in the ward is bald. And she thinks this is a part of life. And she can't keep her food down. And you're not prepared for this. There's no books. There's no home ed class to teach you how to deal with this. And you can't go to a therapist because in the black world, a therapist is taboo, as reserved for rich white people. So you're trying to figure it out. What did I do? Maybe it's something I did. Maybe it's something my wife did. Maybe my doctor diagnosed it erroneously, something. But at night, I still have to be a comic. I have to work on The Tonight Show because that's what I'm going to do. I'm a clown. I'm a clown whose medical bills are raising, who's one step from being evicted, who's one step from getting his car repoed, and I have to come out and make you laugh because no one wants to hear the clown in pain because that's not funny. And my humor is becoming dark, and it's biting, and it's becoming hateful. And the talent coordinator is seeing that there's a problem because the NBC is all about nice and just everything is going to be okay. And we're starting to buck horns because he wants everything light, and I want to be honest and tell life. And I'm hurting, and I want everybody else to hurt. Because somebody is to blame for this. So I buck up, and I suppress my anger, and I form and develop a nice, cute routine for the second Tonight Show. And I get applause breaks, and I get asked to come back for a third time. And I'm perfecting my third set. And the doctor asked me to come in, and I know something's wrong because even the doctor is crying, and doctors don't cry. And he said that we've done all we can. there's nothing else for us to do. And I said, how much time does she have? And he said, at the most, 6 minutes, 6 weeks, I'm sorry. And I should plan for that. And I'm thinking, how do I plan for that? I haven't planned to buy her her first bicycle. I haven't planned to walk her to school. I haven't planned to take pictures of her on her prom. I haven't planned to walk her down the aisle to get married. How am I going to plan to buy her a dress to be buried in? And I'm trying to keep it together because I'm the man, and I'm the man of the house, and I don't want to cry, but it's coming, and I'm trying to tell myself, Tony, I'm trying to beg the world, just give me a chance, just give me a chance, just let me take a breath, just stop just for a minute. I want to call my parents and tell them, what do I do? I don't know what to do. I'm a grown man, and I don't know what to do. And a voice in me comes up like Denzel from Training Day. Man up! You think you're the only one losing kids today? 25 kids walked in here with cancer, only 5 walking out. This ain't no sitcom. It don't wrap up all nice and tidy in 30 minutes. This is life. Welcome to the real world. And he was right. So I bucked up, because that's what I'm supposed to do. And on my third Tonight Show, by that time my daughter had died. And I had 6 applause breaks that night. No one knew I was mourning. No one knew that I could care less about the Tonight Show or Johnny Carson. In 1990, I had 3 appearances with the legendary Johnny Carson and a total of 14 applause breaks. And I would have given it all if I could just have one more day sharing a bag of French fries with my daughter. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Thank you.
Wow. That's what raw pain looks like. That's what an open wound looks like. For 13 long years, he didn't talk about this. He stuffed it somewhere deep inside. Don't want to talk about it. Buck up, suppress it, bury it as deep as you can. And that is the worst possible mistake we can make. The science of psychology teaches us that, and so does the Bible. Last week, I began to introduce this concept from theologian Frederick Buechner called the stewardship of pain. In church lingo, being a good steward means being faithful to and making the most of the opportunities that God gives to us. Buechner's insight is to apply that concept to our pain. For guidance, for what it looks like to be a good steward of our pain, he points us to Jesus' most famous stewardship parable, found in Matthew 25, where Jesus tells the story of a wealthy farmer who's getting ready to go on a really long journey. So he summons his three most trusted servants and decides to entrust them each with a portion of his, that story got me weeping a little bit. He decided to entrust them with a portion of his financial assets. Take good care of this until I return. Two of those three servants decided to make wise investments. Now, anytime you make an investment, there is a risk of loss. But they decided the risk was worth the potential reward. They invested wisely. And when their master returned, they were able to give back to him not just what he had entrusted to them, but in addition to that, additional dividends and earnings from their investment. Well done, good and faithful servants, the master said to them. But the third servant followed a very different strategy. Matthew chapter 25, verse 18. The third servant went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. When his master returned from the long journey, this third servant explained his strategy, his approach to his master. Verse 25, he says to the master, I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent. That word talent is a reference to an ancient unit of measurement of money equal to about $500,000. So he says, I was afraid, and I went and hid your $500,000 in the ground. Here, you have back what is yours. But the master was not amused. Verse 26, you wicked and lazy servant. You ought to have at least invested my money with the bankers. And on my return, I would have received what was my own with at least a little bit of interest. From this parable, we draw the lesson that God expects us to make the most of the experiences that life gives us. And from this parable, we also draw the lesson that the worst possible thing that a steward can do, even if you're stewarding an experience of deepest pain, the worst possible thing that a steward can do, according to Jesus' parable, is what? To bury it. Because what happens when you bury something? It starts to rot. It starts to decay. One evening, two tourists were walking through downtown Vienna, Austria, when they came to Central Cemetery, located in downtown Vienna, a cemetery where several historic figures have been buried. As they're walking through Central Cemetery, they come to the grave of Ludwig Beethoven. As they're standing there, taking this all in, something strange started to happen. They heard music coming from the ground. One of them bent down, put his ear to the ground, and said to the other, it sounds like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony played backwards. About then, a graveyard worker was passing by, and so they flagged him down, brought him over, and said, do you hear that? The worker says, oh, yeah. He says, don't worry about that. That's just Beethoven decomposing. What happens when we bury something? It begins to decompose, to decay, to rot, and to give off toxins within us. For many long years, Anthony Griffith tried to bury his pain deep within him. Don't want to talk about it. Just push it down inside. Maybe it will go away until it started coming out sideways, causing him to be zombie-like, to be listless, ultimately to become suicidal. It became an existential threat to his very being. It became an open wound on his soul and psyche. He was a dead man walking. And the same thing will happen to you and me if we make that mistake. So what's the solution? Take a clue from Jesus' stewardship parable. Take a clue from Jesus' own crucifixion and resurrection. The first rule for rising from the dead is not to stay buried. In his 2017 book, Behind the Laughter, Anthony Griffith tells how in 2003, what you just saw, when he began finally to speak about his deep buried pain, he says, that was the point when I began to heal. It was a process, of course, but that was the point when I began to heal those deepest wounds in my life. It was scary, it was raw, it was counterintuitive. The most counterintuitive thing in the world is to think that the way through my pain is to go deeper into it. And yet, that's exactly what we have to do to heal. What is the greatest wound that life has inflicted on you? The first key biblical step to healing from that wound, to beginning the healing process, is very simply put, to dig it up, to not let it stay buried. Start talking about it. Talk about it to yourself. Talk about it to God. Talk about it to trusted others. Talk about it maybe even to a therapist or a pastor. Maybe even to the person who inflicted that deep wound on you. Or maybe just sit down and write about it in your journal. But whatever you do, don't let it stay buried. Dig it up and begin to process it. Okay, Jeff, you may say, I hear that and that makes sense, but process it how? That brings us to the other step, the second key step. And when you hear this second key step, you may be tempted to think that it's too simplistic. But it's not. It's at once simple and profound. Because it takes time. It takes intentionality. It takes practice. Healing is a process. But this past week, as God laid this second step on my heart, I found myself wrestling with that and saying, God, it's just too simplistic. It just sounds like happy words. But the Holy Spirit kept impressing on me that this second step is what makes the critical difference between wallowing in our pain and healing from our pain. If the first step to healing from our deepest life wounds is to dig it up, don't let it stay buried, the second key step is to then process that pain by showering it with compassion. Let me explain what I mean by that. When I was 11 years old, our family dog was a beautiful basset hound that we had named Fritzy Sue. We got Fritzy when she was just a little puppy, and she became my best buddy. I just fell in love with Fritzy. Then one day, excuse me, she got loose. got out in the street and got hit by a car. Mom found her, rushed her to the emergency vet, wouldn't let us kids see her, wouldn't let us kids accompany her. She said, stay here. So I'm stuck at the house for an hour or two while Mom rushes Fritzy to the emergency vet, and I'm anxious and I'm worried. So to kill time, I went down to our basement where I had a basketball goal, a 6-foot basketball goal in the basement, so that when it was cold outside, I could still shoot baskets. And so I went downstairs to the basement to shoot baskets to kill time. Finally, a couple hours later, Mom comes back home, comes down the steps, and says, Jeff, I'm sorry, but Fritzy didn't make it. I said, okay, and turned and resumed shooting baskets. That's all I said. So Mom went back upstairs. But as I continued shooting baskets, between every third or fourth shot, I would take the basketball and fling it into the backboard as hard as I could. Wham! 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 Before long, Mom came back downstairs, walked over to me, got in my space, wrapped her arms around me, and said, oh, honey, it's okay to cry. And I dissolved into tears. That's what I mean when I say, shower it with compassion. And by it, I mean the event itself that caused so much pain. I mean you as you were at the time of the event. I mean them, anyone who may have caused that pain. I mean you as you are now, and even God. Ask, what does it look like to feel compassion for who I was at the time that great wound was inflicted? And then picture arms of everlasting love wrapping around the you who was at the time the wound was inflicted. Then ask, what does it look like to feel compassion for the me who is now, who is a result of that great and painful experience? And then picture arms of everlasting love wrapping around the you who is now the product of that great wound. Then ask, what does it look like to feel compassion for the event itself? Picture the event itself wrapped in arms of everlasting love. And then, if you dare, picture what it would look like to feel compassion for the one who perpetrated that hurt on you. And I know that is not easy. I was talking to somebody the other day. He said, my ex-girlfriend has weekly sessions with the devil, how to become more evil. I don't know how much she charges him. The person who hurt you may be so evil, they could teach the devil some lessons. But it's not about them. And it does us no good to let what they did embitter our own souls and release toxins within us. Remember, hurting people hurt, and they are the product of the distortion of their own pain. So dare to picture what it would look like to feel compassion for them and to imagine them being wrapped in arms of everlasting love. Then picture God and whatever blame you may have assigned to God for letting it happen. Recognize how hard it must be to be God. And ask, what does it look like to feel compassion for God? There is No force in the cosmos more powerful than the compassion, the love of God. Our bitterness is not going to heal our wounds, but grace can and will. Okay, Jeff, you may say, I hear what you're saying, but what on earth does this have to do with Easter? Everything. Because the two-step process that we've just been talking about, dig it up and then shower it with compassion, is precisely the pattern we see unfolding in our Easter gospel passage in John chapter 21. It is exactly the process that Jesus leads Simon Peter through in that resurrection appearance recorded in John chapter 21. You're probably roughly familiar with the backstory to our gospel passage, how on the night of Jesus' trial, the night before his crucifixion, Peter followed Jesus once he was arrested to that trial site. And there's a woman who recognizes Peter there and says to him, aren't you also one of his followers? Peter, in the heat of the moment, realizing that if he says yes, he too could be arrested and might be crucified, Peter, in the heat of the moment, says, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't even know this Jesus. Now remember, just a short time earlier, Peter had assured Jesus that even if all of the other disciples deserted him, he, Peter, loved him so much he would never abandon Jesus. But now, in the pressure of the moment, he was doing that very thing, not just once. This woman was persistent three times. Peter is asked, aren't you one of his disciples as well? Three times Peter denies it. In fact, the third time, for emphasis, the text tells us that Peter cursed and then swore an oath, I swear by God Almighty, I do not know this man. Then the text says Peter went out and wept bitterly. For Simon Peter, this was one of his life's deepest wounds and most shameful experiences. This one he loved so much, his mentor. In the moment of crisis, he betrays him and denies him. And in the aftermath, is so devastated by this that Simon Peter convinces himself that he is no longer worthy to be part of the Jesus movement, let alone a leader in it, that the only thing left for him to do is to go back home and resume his life as a fisherman the way he was before he met Jesus. And so that's what Simon Peter does. But in our gospel story, as it picks up the story, we're told that Jesus finds him there, sees him with some others out in a boat off of the shore, and Jesus calls him in to shore, where they find that Jesus has prepared a breakfast for them on the open fire. And then after the breakfast, Jesus engages Simon Peter in a direct conversation. John chapter 21, verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, do you love me more than these? You see what Jesus is doing there, right? He's not leaving it alone. He's digging it up. He is going directly to the point of Simon Peter's deepest pain and ripping the scab off. Simon Peter, remember, you said you loved me so much more than these others that even if they deserted me, you would never abandon me. He's taking Peter right back to that moment, that open wound, not out of malice, but because Jesus knows that if Simon Peter is going to heal from this, he's going to have to face his pain. But Jesus doesn't stop there. Watch what he does next. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, do you love me more than these? Peter said, yes, Lord, you know I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. You see what he's doing there. This is step two. He's restoring Simon Peter to leadership in the Jesus movement. He's saying, I still want you. He's showering him with compassion and wrapping around him arms of everlasting love. And Jesus doesn't do this just once with Simon Peter. As the gospel story unfolds, Jesus repeats the same sequence verbatim three times in a row, because Jesus knows healing is not a one-time thing. It takes time and practice and intentionality. It's a process. So three different times, Jesus drags Peter back through the pain, and three different times, he showers him with compassion until Peter is finally healed. And talk about rising from his pain. Simon Peter would go on to become the paramount leader of the Jesus movement, of early Christianity. Simon Peter would become the very rock upon which Jesus was going to build his church. Because like Jesus before him, instead of letting his wounds bury him, Simon Peter, let them make him better, stronger, wiser, more compassionate, more beautiful. What's the deepest wound life has ever inflicted on you? Where are you in the healing process? Let me close with this. It's a poem that I really love because it echoes so beautifully what we've been talking about, the sequence that we see in John 21. It's a poem by Pesha Joyce Gertler called The Healing Time. Listen to these words. Let them sink in to your soul. Finally, on my way to yes, I bump into all the places where I said no to my life. All the unintended wounds, the red and purple scars, those hieroglyphs of pain carved into my skin, my bones, those coded messages that send me down the wrong street again and again, where I find them, the old wounds, the old misdirections, and I lift them one by one close to my heart, and I say, holy, holy. I take the deepest wounds of my life, dig them up, hold them close to my heart, and say, holy, holy. This week, I want to invite you to do that. If life has wounded you, I want to invite you to follow through the pattern of John chapter 21. So I'm going to invite you this week, if you feel so called, to participate in a guided meditation first developed at Stanford University called the Loving Kindness Meditation. But this meditation, I've adapted it to apply to the specific circumstances that we're talking about today, our deepest woundedness in life. This meditation, you'll find it at a link on your feed in the comments section on Facebook Live. You'll find it, the same link, if you're on YouTube or watching this on our church website, you'll find the link there as well. I invite you this week to spend some time moving through this meditation, and over the course of time, to move through it periodically as often as it takes until you find healing. This meditation is designed to enable us to have the same conversation with ourselves as Jesus had with Simon Peter in John chapter 21. Basically, it's to take ourselves back to the point of our greatest pain. As painful as it is, to allow ourselves to feel that again, dig it up. But then to picture ourselves as we were then, at the point of the wound, being wrapped in God's arms of everlasting love. Then repeating that process for ourselves, the person you are now, as a result of that experience, and then for the event itself, and then for the person who hurt you, then for God, and lastly, for every living creature that was, is, or now experiences deep life wounds, because compassion is holistic, not compartmentalized. And I know this may sound a little new agey, but there's nothing more biblical than channeling the compassion of God. My old wounds and misdirections, I lift them up to my heart one by one and say, holy, holy. I shower them with compassion. I embrace them, determined that, like Jesus Christ before me, I will not stay stuck in my woundedness, but I will rise to new life. My wounds will be transformed into scars that proclaim how much I've overcome. Like Christ, I will rise. Because that's what Easter is all about. New life in Christ. Easter applied.